Hey team, you're about to listen to my interview with Henry Innes, the co-founder and CEO of Mutinex out of Sydney, Australia. Mutinex is a predictive business intelligence platform for marketers. It helps you understand what has worked in the past in your marketing so that you can make smarter decisions for the future of your marketing. Hope you enjoy the interview. This is the E-Commerce Edge podcast with your host, Jason Greenwood. Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of the podcast. I have a very interesting conversation, I think, lined up for you. I probably have as many questions out there for you, that very similar questions, the kind of questions you guys would ask of the next gentleman that I'm going to interview today. I'm very proud to welcome Henry Innes from Mutinex to the pod. Welcome, mate.
Hi, Jason. Great to be here.
Awesome to have you along today for the ride. I was doing a bit of pre-research about Mutinex, and I was looking at your website. I was looking through the collateral. I've never used your software platform before, but you bill yourself, you call yourself, as your tagline is the growth OS, retail brands in particular, but your focus really is on e-commerce and knowing how and where your marketing is being best spent.
Yeah, so we do it end to end. I mean, the function of growth OS is to provide growth investment analytics, right? We all invest money in things. We're all probably pretty familiar with attribution and other kind of similar. The purpose of something like Growth OS is to really deliver end-to-end omni-channel insight into what's actually driving incremental growth or incrementalism, and conversely, what's not. The reason that we focus so much in that space is because most attribution is kind of pretty weak, in as you'd call it. If I look at last click and if I look at MTA, both are methodologies that aren't really based in causation or did this fundamentally change our revenue. They're more based in correlation. Did we see a user pass this at some point in the funnel? Now, just because somebody passed something doesn't necessarily mean it changed their behavior. We don't know if it made them change left or right and how much it influenced the change from left to right. So that's what we build Growth OS as. It's effectively a revenue predictor around advertising, app marketing, and growth. The critical difference is that we're not trying to use cookies or things like that to follow people along the journey. What we're really looking at is if spend goes up in TV, if spend goes up in search, how did that change our revenue trend up or down? And then that will give us a really good sense of, if you're doing these five things, this is the likely revenue improvement that you're going to get. So it's a little bit different to the conventional attribution models, which dominate e-commerce. The techniques and underlying principles themselves, they're not exactly new. Everybody talks about AI and machine learning. I'm one of those people who thinks AI and machine learning has been around for 30 years. So why is it so new and shiny? What we're doing is we're speeding up the process quite dramatically for people. And we're speeding up the process quite dramatically to execute what we would call a market mix model, putting it in a platform experience and really transforming
that. And effectively, platform that's a SaaS platform that can plug into all of the different systems where you need to get this data from. Now, most merchants will be using a combination of, say, Google Analytics, Google Tag Manager. They may be using a third-party tag manager. They may be using something like Triple Whale or Northbeam to try to do something around attribution and source analytics. They might be running a BI tool in addition to all of this, where they're exporting a whole bunch of data out of certain systems, ERPs, CRMs, e-commerce platforms, POS systems, etc. And then they're trying to run analytics, oftentimes sales and revenue analytics inside of a BI platform. But where do you feel like you fit, or do you feel like you're a category creator and that really you don't fit the model of any of these other tools or platforms that are out there in the market today?
The other tools and platforms are running a fairly basic, what we would call an unopinionated model. And what I really mean by that is, it's not encoding marketing science into a statistical model. So what they tend to do is they tend to be really good at visualizing something. What they're not so good at doing is predicting what will happen with a combination of elements. So we view ourselves as a foundational model business. Foundational model businesses were really pioneered by the likes of kind of Google around some of how they put their vision APIs out on Google Cloud and things like that. Probably they're in the zeitgeist at the moment, driven by OpenAI and ChatGPT, but by no means were they the leading business. So we see ourselves as a foundational model in growth, if that makes sense. So what people are buying is not just the visualization, but our model and our generalized AI's ability to make sense of the data and then make sense of it in a predictive way. I think that all the tools that you spoke about and things like that, where I come from a data perspective is really a first principles perspective, which is, what do you fundamentally need from a data perspective or an information perspective to build these sorts of models, whether it be market mix or any other kind of statistical model? And really what you need to know is how much you're spending week to week, so you can see the change, what your sales were, and what your pricing was. Potentially, if you're in retail, which I know most listeners won't be, what your distribution was as well. If you got those four components extracted in a weekly time series and a reliable source into a data warehouse, there's a hell of a lot you can do with that. And so from my perspective, I don't really look at the individual tools so much as the first principles of what do we need good data to look like in a weekly time series type grain, which is your spend, your pricing, your sales, and your distribution, so that you can effectively understand how did the mix change in a relative fashion week to week. And it's a far more effective way to analyze what your mix looked like at a given point in time and how that affected your overall sale. You can visualize that in BI tools to kind of eyeball it really neatly, and that's actually something we like to do quite a lot in what we would call an EDA. So, you know, you take a plot line of your TV spend week to week, your online video spend week to week, and maybe your display retargeting week to week, and then take a plot line of your sales trend. You can actually usually intuitively where the spikes are, where they aren't, and get a sense of what part of the mix was spiking when that spike happened. But quantifying that's a lot harder, and quantifying exactly what that spike was, what led up to it, and things like that, and exactly what the ROI and dollar payback was, is really difficult. And so that's what we do. We quantify that intuitive human ability to eyeball those plot lines and convert that into real hard data points.
And obviously, merchants will oftentimes have multiple transactional channels versus multiple marketing channels. And so I'm guessing you need to plug into all of those to be able to get a holistic view of where the revenue is coming from and where the spend is coming from, so that you can fully inform your data models. And so let's say they're an omni-channel retailer and they sell online and they sell in physical stores, and they've got a 20 retail store. Would you break down in your models, do you need to break down the weekly revenue of, say, the online store versus each individual retail store down to the location and the region, et cetera, so that then you can also compare, let's say you were running a local TV ad in a given state of Australia or a given city. I guess the real question here that I'm asking is, which systems do you typically have to plug into to get a complete enough data set to make your predictions statistically relevant and accurate? And are you plugging into things like the Google Ads platform? Are you plugging into Facebook Ads platform? Are you plugging into their TVC ad manager if they've got one? Are you plugging into their ERP? What are you plugging into the POS system? What types of systems would you typically be extracting data from to be able to do and run with high accuracy your modeling?
So the types of systems are the ones you've mentioned. You effectively want to plug into a sales data source. Usually that's some variant of an ERP system. Occasionally it's just a conversion system online, so GA Analytics, Google Analytics, Adobe Analytics, that kind of thing. Quite often it's some kind of ERP system or an existing sales report via the BI tool, Tableau or Domo or something like that. If I look then to the media systems, it's all of your usual ones, but the really common ones within the e-commerce space are Facebook, Google, GMP, so Google Marketing Platform, obviously DV360, all of those sorts of ones. The strength of all of these platforms is they all contain the attributes that you'd like. I would just say on the retail storefront, we probably would just aggregate all the retail stores up and then break out by states or something along those lines is generally what we would see most people doing. Most people might get down to cities as well. And again, we would put constraints around that just to understand where was this spend geographically and where were these stores or where was these transactions geographically. I think the strength of most data now, I know everybody likes to whinge about data at the moment, but most data has gotten pretty good, and particularly around geography. Most of the fields have been standardized really neatly. So, under Facebook, I've got a really strong region field, which is very easy to extract. Under, if I go into YouTube's world, the data for market mix modeling that Google gives off, and I'm actually giving a webinar with Google later today, is pretty unbelievably good. And it's just a question of knowing how to call it through the APIs. For simplicity's sake, generally we use an API aggregator to do a lot of the digital legwork. So we're using Supermix, another really good one to use, which is an Aussie business, is Data Slayer as well. Both are really effective at aggregating data off these APIs, configuring them, doing an extraction, and then bringing it into BigQuery, which is our current preferred environment. Though I'd also just say Snowflake is absolutely amazing. So that's how we think about it. We look at all of those systems at source. We use Supermetrics largely to aggregate the pipeline, and then we try to get it all into a standardized data warehouse with the attributes that we want.
Wow. And this, I've never heard of this type of, I guess, for lack of a better term, retail operating system or retail marketing spend operating system. The typical BI tools, you'd have to really build out something quite hyper custom. Even in Microsoft's Power BI, you'd have to do some really heavy lifting in there. You'd have to have probably a data scientist or at least a data analyst on your team or team of them. So do you guys really see yourselves as a turnkey BI tool specifically targeted at marketing ROI for retailers? Is that really how you see yourselves fitting into the ecosystem? Or do you feel like you're really pushing the boundaries and creating a completely new category of software for retail?
I wouldn't say just retail, obviously in financial services and things like that as well. So I'll just caveat that comment with that. We're across multiple categories, but in the retail context, yes. Ideally, the theory with foundational model businesses is that in order for you to execute on a really good model in-house, you're going to have to bring in 3 to 4 data scientists who are going to build you a model. And then that model is only really going to be able to be calibrated well twice a year because of the effort that goes into it. A foundational model business will come in and say, actually, we deeply understand this problem and how to build a generalized model in it and constantly just optimize the one model and the one statistical model, which will work across categories, across areas to solve this particular, or to generate data around this particular problem. We see ourselves as the turnkey solution in that space. I will say that we think it's category creation because, to your point, everybody is currently using teams of data scientists to do this, and it makes it incredibly inaccessible for most organizations to do good, robust modeling that actually gives them a strong sense of end-to-end marketing ROI across their ecosystem. I personally just don't think that's good for competition. I don't think that's good for progress. And I just don't think it's also an efficient use of resources for data scientists to be fundamentally working on custom and bespoke solutions all the time. So that's why we have taken this position of a very strong foundational model business that's really going to pioneer this space in growth and create the turnkey generalized model within the growth sector.
That makes complete sense. I'm interviewing founders every day that are, creating the next SaaS platform for whatever. It's typically relates specifically to e-com. But what I'm hearing over and over again is that one of their driving forces behind what they're doing is the democratization of that functionality, whatever it might be. And we see that across almost every single segment, category, and vertical of software. Even if we just break it down into subsets sitting underneath e-com, what we're seeing is we're seeing the competition out there, the rationalization, we're seeing a whole lot of cannibalization of business out there because there are so many software providers that are rushing to the same end goal with their software. But what the net effect of that is that, yes, there's more competition in the space than ever before, but the end result is that technology that would formerly only have been accessible to the very, very largest of businesses, basically the top, say, 20% in any given vertical of business, that's the only people that would have been able to access this type of high-end technology. But now what we're seeing is we're seeing smaller players come in and we're seeing dramatic consolidation in almost every software category. And the net effect is that's now democratized to the point where even SMBs in most cases can access technology that even 5 years ago just simply wouldn't have been accessible to them.
I completely agree. And I think there's two interesting things about democratization, which is the why and then the real effect of it. If you look at the democratization of tooling, the number one thing that software does, and The Innovator's Dilemma, I think, is a phenomenal book. Have you read it, Jason?
No, I've listened to the Blinkist. I subscribe to Blinkist, and I've listened to the blink of it, though, and it is pretty incredible.
Yeah, awesome. So fundamentally, like, The Innovator's Dilemma talks about the trap of large existing incumbents. What a large existing incumbent's problem will be is they have a certain amount of revenue that they have to maintain to keep the expectations of their company, their shareholders, their boards. And then they have a certain amount of margin and processes that are embedded into how they operate. When you get to be big enough, your fundamental job becomes risk mitigation to protect your revenue rather than innovating a category. And it's an inevitable trap. It's why I don't think I'll ever be a CEO of a company more than 1,000 people, because I just don't think that I would be very good at it. If I look at how that works and how that plays out within what we're talking about, most software businesses are seeing problems where they can have a 10 times better solution at a 90% cheaper price point, delivering that to market. And that's how they are fundamentally disrupting that market. And you've seen that time and time again with, you know, Figma going up against Adobe. Everyone would have said Adobe would have won, but Figma was coming out the winner. In the e-commerce world, I look at massive pharmaceutical companies versus a business that I spoke to you about in before this podcast, Jason, a business like Eucalyptus, which is one of the fastest growing and most brilliant e-commerce businesses in the Australian market. There's other great examples, like I love Booktopia taking on Dimix to a degree. That's another great example. But I think of the end state of this, one of the really interesting things that I looked at was Marc Andreessen from Andreessen Horowitz has an amazing Substack, which I highly recommend anyone to look at. And he looks at the level of inflation from the Bureau of Labor. Now, we all like to talk about inflation. It's a really hot topic at the moment. Computer software from 2000 to current day has gotten close to 80% cheaper than it was in the year 2000. So what that tells you is that the actual category of computer software, software available to SMBs and things like that, it's actually been a massively deflationary category. And that's why we're getting more and more nimble e-commerce players able to access better tooling, able to access better insights and better technology that equips them to be just as productive as a 500 to 1,000 person organization in the space.
You know, that's such a key thing. I think that there's the economic impact in a meta sense, but then there's the local impact for what is still today, and it won't probably always be that way, but still, when we think of the key driver of GDP in, at least speaking broadly across the Western world, we see that SMBs still make up from anywhere from 60 to 90% of GDP, right? And so when you think of it through that lens, it makes sense that not only is the TAM going to be concentrated largely in SMBs for these software vendors, but also they will have the greatest impact if they can bring down the cost of their software through scaling that allows them to be broadly acceptable and democratized. Then that is the marriage of the realistic TAM of their software and the people being able to actually access it and deploy it and manage it and run it in their own businesses. And what I like about your software and what you've told me about it so far is the fact that it's largely turnkey, meaning you plug it in, you turn it on, it starts accepting data in a standardized way, it runs its algorithms on that data, and based on the statistical modeling that you've done and built into the platform, and then it spits out an answer for all intents and purposes, or at least it spits out a likely trend for, and based on that trend line and tweaking with the inputs that you would say, okay, what would happen if we next month, what would happen if we doubled our spend in our TVC spend? What if we doubled that next month? What is that likely to do to our bottom line? Then now you can model that out and you can create some pretty accurate forecasts of which levers to turn and what the outcome would be if you tweak those levers.
Yeah, and that's absolutely right. And I think that's where pretty much most marketers, retailers, people in e-commerce, that's where they want to be. If you're moving in a fast transaction environment where you're trying to generate volume quickly, understanding where your levers for volume is critical. And I think particularly as well, understanding, was it the Black Friday sales event or was it all my advertising in the lead up as well that made the difference? Things like that are really important to understand strategically. Well, do we need to invest in the lead up or can we leave it? Is advertising after Black Friday going to be of benefit? Has everyone been exhausted in their sales and the sales just always going to be decreased during that period? Those sorts of insights are just absolutely critical and crucial to making good decisions. As a company, we like to think of ourselves as, and kind of our internal mantra and missions is, how do we help marketers, people interested in growth, people interested in improving revenue, make better decisions? And if we can do that, and if we can help somebody get to 10 better growth decisions throughout a year that generate, say, 2 million extra incremental revenue, we pay for ourselves. So that's why I think the product, that kind of product orientation as well, of what value are you contributing to the ecosystem? How are you giving people better information around what's happening in retail, e-commerce, around sales events, around their market mix, around all of these different aspects so that they can make the right decision with the right data? It's an absolutely crucial part of where things are going to go. And I think in the future, most people and most marketers will be a lot more data-driven than they think, not because people are going to get more mathematical, but because they're going to have really good platforms sitting alongside them that will actually make the mathematics more easy, accessible, and make the decision more obvious and clear.
I think you make a very good point, which is that there's not enough data scientists in the world today. There's not enough data engineers in the world today. There's not enough data analysts in the world today to meet the ever-increasing need for this type of skill and capability inside a business. So why wouldn't we be more efficient with the resources in market that we have available by, for example, having 5 of the top data scientists in the world working for Mutinex instead? And then that, it by extension, can service 1,000 businesses, 1 million businesses, because you're a SaaS platform. And so really, it democratizes access to those skill sets, not just the technology, but the capability, the skill sets, the knowledge, the experience, the genius, really, that exists in limited quantities out there. You're democratizing access to that skill set via a software platform. And that, to me, is the game changer, especially for small businesses, because a small, medium business, even if they're doing $20, $30, $40 million a year, when you're looking at data scientists that are making, in some cases, they're making $300,000, $400,000, $500,000, $600,000 a year because they're rare as hen's teeth, and now all of a sudden, for a lot less cost than that, they can access effectively the collective capability and skill of all the people working inside Mutinex.
That's right. What's really interesting, and I have a slightly funny view of what Atlassian and Canva, and to an extent Mutinex, are. Are you familiar with Atlassian and Canva? I assume you would be.
Oh, of course. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. I think that Canva is just Mel Perkins' opinion on how to design a book really well that's been really well scaled through product. So rather than Mel Perkins having to sit there in every single room and say, here's how to lay out a book brilliantly, and here's how I can teach you to do it, she's actually just designed a workflow, a system, the support tools of exactly what she would do, and scaled that in a product. So in a sense, made Mel's genius accessible to the world through product. I think Atlassian and Jira are pretty similar for the Atlassian co-founders, in the sense that what they have effectively done is had a really strong opinion on how best to build software products, built an amazing interface around that, and built an amazing backend that supports that interface. And what that really is an opinion scaled into a product. Most great products, in my view, are opinionated, and they do effectively scale that opinion, that limited quantity of geniuses out to the world in a way where people are able to access it and access the impact of that opinion en masse. Everyone likes to think of SaaS as a really like objective thing, but I think that in a large part, most great SaaS interfaces are very opinionated and force the user to think in the vein of a certain opinion. And even if I go down to other e-commerce platforms, I think the greatest piece of opinionated software within the e-commerce is Shopify. Shopify literally drives you on rails to a degree on how you should build and transact in e-commerce. Now, is it as customizable as some of the really complex ERP enterprise systems? Probably not. And it probably wouldn't work at top tier enterprise. But what has it done? It's created and enabled 40,000 merchants to operate a pretty good e-commerce store based on what someone knew worked in e-commerce. And so that to me is an amazing example of how an opinionated product can completely open up the market in something like e-commerce and just fundamentally revolutionize it.
I totally agree. Now, Shopify is now scaled to the point where now that they've got over 2 million sites running on the platform. That tells you the power of an opinion or the power of genius crystallized. And I think the iPhone is an example of that with Steve Jobs and Johnny Ive and having a super strong, as you say, I love that term that you've said, having a very strong opinion and then going to market with that opinion and scaling that in market as your lens, your view of the world, your view of that product and how it should be built and how it should be interacted with. And really, to a large degree, ignoring what the rest of the market says, particularly if you're in the position of category creation, you have to ignore what the market says because you're now building something that there is no precedent for in the market. And I think that's really important. And it sounds like you've taken a similar path with MutantX, which is we have an opinion. We think this thing needs to exist in the world. It doesn't currently exist in the world today. So bloody hell, we're going to go and build it. We're going to commercialize it. We're going to scale it. And this is how we're going to make our money.
Yeah. And I think we've just got a view of how marketing science works in a statistical context and a very strong view within our data science team, which is very aligned, and we know that it works. And so I think that's a really important part of building these businesses is to not shy away from that. But I think how that the way I think about the next phase of the business is, as you say, we've got to continue to drive accessibility, because I know that SMB merchants, for example, right now, to your point before, they can't afford data scientists, but even data analysts is really challenging and difficult. And the ability to organize and make sense of your data before it gets into the BI tools, I think that's the next area we'll look really closely at. Because what I'm seeing consistently when I speak to any kind of business of any size is that in order to get data into a shape where it's well organized, you don't just need access to the APIs. You then need to then map and make sense of that data in a way that aligns to a decision. And I'll give you an example of that. If my fundamental strategy is I've got a regional strategy and a metro strategy, and what I believe to be true, or the way that I'm executing my strategy, is I'm going to be taking a different approach to regions than metro. But all of my data is organized into New South Wales versus Victoria from a geography perspective. I will never be able to generate an insight as to were my metro stores performing better than my regional stores and why. And so that concept of organizing the inputs really well around a decision, organizing the inputs brilliantly around how do we need to do things and what do we need to analyze so that the data isn't just being modeled, but it's being modeled against the decisions that you want to or can make is absolutely crucial. So if I go in the e-commerce world, one of the things that I think is really common is just modeling sales. So just modeling your top line revenue, your top line sales. Where I think the space goes next is most people, particularly as omni-channel and e-commerce become more common, and particularly as digital video and online video and broadcast video on demand starts to dominate over pure play linear television, where I think the market then goes is, well, most retailers, mid-size, small, major, will be thinking in terms of how do I model out each sales channel so that I know is offline affecting my offline media or BVOD or linear television or regional radio affecting my e-commerce sales? Is my online media, so you know, my performance display, affecting people walking into my stores and transacting? I'm modeling all of those things next and actually looking at those effects going back and forth. That's something a market mix model does. But I think increasingly as the world converges, that type of decision-making and analysis around sales channels, what's happening in your sales channels, why your sales channels are being driven, and whether and how the whole ecosystem works to support both on and offline or on online plus off, going to be in the next wave of decision-making that people are going to make in this.
And I'm guessing that with that strong supposition in mind, I'm guessing that is part of your roadmap. And is there anything that your customers are asking for today that you don't do, or as part of that roadmap that you envisage over maybe the next 2 to 5 years, is that really the foundation of where you'd like to take the platform?
I think I come back to that lovely word decision. It must sound like a broken record to your listeners, but where we want the platform to be in Market Mix is ultimately automating recommendations for customers. So you can plug your data in, the algorithm will model it. You'll then have a whole heap of decisions that can be uncovered or recommendations that can be uncovered throughout that data set in a fairly granular way. So rather than saying, move 20% of your TV budget here to social, it'll say, on these 30 weeks, if you adjusted your mix by this, you would have benefited like this. I think that's the future of the space, is actually data mining recommendations and moving away from the big BI tools and towards more natural language recommendation insights that are coming off the platform. The second kind of area I think is very interesting is we've seen the rise of large language models. I personally hate how overdone the trend is, but what I'm seeing and what I am focused on within our roadmap is how do we put large language querying into our ecosystem going forward? Because again, I should be able to say, hey, Black Friday is coming up and I've got an extra $10,000 to spend. What's my best tactic? The model should be able to then consider, do you offer free shipping and advertise it via Instagram? Do you run it all on SMS blast? What do you do? And if you can have an ability for kind of natural language to interface with a complex statistical growth model, I think that's an incredible tool that could be unlocked by the next kind of generation of artificial intelligence.
And how do you see things fitting in that your model might not be able to tell you with accuracy because of the human psychology impact? And I'll give you an example. So your model might today tell me, okay, based on my market mix of today, and part of that market mix might be SMS and email, based on our statistic modeling, if we, during the 30 days pre-Black Friday, if we put out an SMS every second day, then we forecast that this would have X impact based on this historical data set. The downside impact of that outside of the pure revenue model might be that we increase our unsubscribe rate to our email list and our SMS list by 30%. And so second and third order effects are something that sit well outside a pure revenue model and even a pure profit model. And they start to take into account the impact on potential future revenues that are impacted by buyer psychology. And so the second and third order impacts of some of the things that you're talking about might not be immediately clear, even with an all-encompassing market mix model.
It's a really good question. I don't know how we're going to deal with that yet, to be perfectly honest with you, but it's certainly something we're trying to consider at the moment, and it's one of the key risks. Broadly, I think that the one thing I just would say back to that is I think what we have learned about revenue models is revenue tends to be fairly collinear, and I say collinear, not causative, of customer happiness. Very rarely do you have a massive spike in revenue and a bunch of unhappy customers. You can, but it's rare. So I do think that fundamentally we're solving for edge cases there. They are definitely risks, but I don't think they will be incredibly common, because the ultimate proof of whether or not you're doing a good job, in my opinion, is whether or not someone's buying you. And if someone's buying your product, it's a much better signal to me than whether they signed up to an email list and things like that. So I take the hypothetical and I agree it's a risk, but do I think it's permeated really heavily? Probably not from what we can see in early stage development. That said, it's super early stage R&D. So I could, the thing about R&D is you always find out you're wrong about something. So
yeah, you've got to have both the positive and the negative feedback loop to beginning the full 360 degree view. Now, how do you guys currently, what your model, SaaS platform, but what's your business model? How do you guys make your money? How do you charge out? What could an SMB type business expect to pay for your platform on, say, a monthly or an annual basis? What does your commercial model look like?
Yeah, so we're a pure play licensing platform. And when I say a pure play licensing platform, someone clicks and subscribes and they can get access to our platform after a period of onboarding and setup. An SMB and things like that, we don't deal with a heap of SMBs. Most businesses, if you're spending above the 2 million mark in media, you'll generally be generating 6 to 7 million in profitability off that media. So a good rule of thumb for us is, if you're spending more than that, the platform will more than pay for itself, because it will easily find some big uplifts. Most customers are paying about 13 to 18,000 a month across a particular business unit or brand. Some are on cheaper deals because they might be on much longer term contracts and things like that. That's how we think about that.
That makes sense, right? If you got $2 million in media spend, right, and you're paying $20,000 a month, let's just say rounding up 13 to 18, but I don't know, maybe 15,000, just split it down the middle on average, then we're talking if you can move the lever. And based on your averages that you're seeing across your entire customer base, and I realize this is an aggregate data, but what kind of additional return on ad spend, say, for example, are you typically able to provide for your customers?
We'd like to talk about it as 10 to 20% is generally the range that we lift profitability or improve efficiency by. And there's two ways that you could do that. Either we'll show you areas where you can invest more and be extremely confident that you'll generate more profitability. So that's, you know, what I mean by generating more top line. Or we'll show you areas that just aren't working or contributing where you can pull spend back and it won't really have much of an impact. It depends on the style of business, which way they go. There are plenty of customers that we have that are really good on the efficiency front. There are plenty that we have that are really good on the business case front. It's very variable on that. So I would just say that, yeah, most businesses that we speak to are really looking for that kind of 10 to 20%. And they're looking for it pretty much every year.
And I guess that aligns with what is that saying in marketing? Only 20% of your marketing spend drives, what is it? It's the Pareto principle, right? I guess 20% of your marketing spend is driving 80% of your results. The problem is you don't know which 20%. So I guess you're trying to solve for that.
Exactly. Yeah. We're trying to find you that portion of the marketing mix, which is really doing the heavy lifting, so that you can either double down on it, or you can pull spend back from the not so hardworking parts of the market mix.
Makes complete sense. And how would you prefer that people get a hold of you guys? I'll just spell it out just if people want to go and visit the website, Mutinex, MUTINEX.co. They can go there. They can get a demo. They can sign up. They can do all those things through your website. Sure. Would you prefer that they get a hold of you there?
Yeah, absolutely. Come through our website. We're extremely responsive. And yeah, we'd love to hear from businesses that are really looking to get a 20% edge in their ROI.
Man, super exciting. I love what you're doing. You're definitely, from the sounds of it, you and your team are a lot more brilliant than I am. And I'm glad you're working on this problem instead of me. So that's very exciting. Now, we're at the point of our time together where I get to flip the script and turn the microphone over to you and let you ask me one question. Any question, you can be personal, can be professional, doesn't matter. So I'd love to turn the microphone over to you, Henry Innes from Mutinex. What's your question for me?
What's the most interesting thing happening in Mexico around e-commerce?
Oh, wow, that's such a great question. I've only been here a month, but I'll tell you what I'm seeing and what is so different about the Mexican market. I may have mentioned this before, but on other podcasts, but I think the thing that I'm recognizing while I'm here is the absolute total and utter dominance of very small businesses, like not chains, like local community businesses across almost every type of business that you can imagine. You'll drive down a street and the street will be literally lined with small businesses, like small shops selling everything that you can think. And that to me, and on our way to Mexico, we stopped in Dubai, we stopped in Barcelona, and then now we're here. And I know the ANZ market very well. I know the North American market very well in terms of at least Canada and the United States. And I guess I just wasn't as aware of the power of the SMB in Mexico until I really started living in local communities, getting outside of Mexico City, which is, of course, ridiculously big, 25 million plus people. So I guess what I'm seeing here is that the Amazon, for example, is going to have an easier time and is having an easier time of it here. And the likes of Mercado Libre and other marketplaces are having a much easier time of it here in terms of their growth strategy, because there's not a huge amount of strip malls. There's very few big box stores here at all. They're just really not that big. Of course, there's Walmart Mexico, but they're nowhere near the scale that they are in the United States. Logistics in this country, the standard mail system in this country is basically non-existent and dysfunctional. So the likes of Amazon, with their own logistics, with their own capability, both first mile, middle mile, last mile, in most cases where they are actually doing the delivery, where they don't have to work with the local postal system in any way, shape, or form, they just don't have competition, because there's no mid-tier aggregator in each category of products in this country. And so you've got all these tiny little localized single players and not a lot between that and an Amazon, which can be the master mercantilist of anything and everything. And as a non-local who's just moved here, I don't know, for example, I don't know which local store I would go to buy I recently bought, as soon as we arrived, I bought off of Amazon, I bought a Google Chromecast. Now, I went into a couple of little electronic stores that I saw attached as part of a couple local malls, but the pricing was outrageous. And so you don't see a Best Buy chain here, for example. And as a result of that, or you don't see to put it in the context of Australia, there's no JB Hi-Fi here, right? That's the context that I'm entering into this market. And I can see why Amazon is growing so fast and why Mercado Libre, because they are the aggregator of retail in these countries that have been built on the back of these ultra small businesses that operate in their local communities only. So it's a really interesting phenomenon. And obviously the language is different and that plays a part in it. The culture is different as a result, which plays a part in it. Yeah, those are the things that I'm really learning here. And I think the rise of marketplaces globally, and to put this in the context of Australia, I see Australia as the most over marketplaced country in the world. I'm not aware of any other country in the world that has as many marketplaces operating in it as Australia. And we're slowly starting to see a bit of consolidation in Australia as a result, but there's a lot more room for regionalized, localized marketplace growth, I think, outside of the traditional English-speaking Western culture. Yeah, I think that's gonna be the story. I think that's gonna be the growth story from what I can see so far. But again, it's very early days for me here.
That's fascinating, isn't it? Because I always think that we never really understand how much or how important aggregation and infrastructure is. It's the most underrated form of infrastructure, in my opinion.
It 100% is. And what we were blown away by is that Amazon delivery here, they must, I don't know this for sure because I haven't read about it, but I assume that they have an Uber-like app, but it's an internal only app inside Amazon operating in Mexico. And the reason I say that is because I have gotten deliveries now after hours. All of my deliveries from Amazon have turned up at my door. Like the person has been knocking on my door 6, 7, 8 p.m. at night. It's a personal vehicle. It's not an Amazon truck that is turned up to deliver. It's someone in their personal vehicle, almost like Uber Eats. And they've got an app on their phone that does all the scanning and the tracking and the signature and all that sort of stuff. But I am guessing that at least for last mile in Mexico, that they hire on a contract basis, almost like an Uber driver, a phalanx of local delivery people that can sign up as delivery drivers for Amazon and use that internal app to effectively claim deliveries from wherever the local warehouse is here, for example, in Querétaro. And they say, okay, after work, I'm going to do deliveries for 3 hours after work. Because the guy that delivered to me yesterday, and it was at like 7 p.m., he said, oh, I've got 4 more deliveries to go before I can call it a night. So I think Amazon has been pretty clever about how they operate regionally and by country and coming up with clever logistical solutions that are market appropriate. Because obviously in Australia, that's not how they operate, right? They've got like Amazon trucks and fully branded end-to-end Amazon infrastructure with employees working for Amazon. But it feels very much like they operate and structure their business to be as effective and efficient as possible on a local base.
Yeah, that's fine.
Absolutely cool. Listen, Henry, it has been absolutely amazing talking with you. I really appreciate your time. And I'd love to talk to you in another 12, 18 months and see how far along you guys have come with your new developments.
Awesome. Thanks so much, Jason.
Are you a B2B or D2C e-commerce merchant? Then head over to greenwoodconsulting.net to learn how we can help you scale your business.